Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and while I have your attention, it would be great if you could leave us a review. It really helps other film lovers find us. Before we dive in, here's a few things happening at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. On October 25th, we're bringing back our Talking Heads Stop Making Sense sing-along. Yes, dancing is encouraged. Also, we're currently remembering two icons with retrospectives on Robert Redford and Claudia Cardinale. Today, Hugo speaks with the incomparable Mark Cousins, filmmaker, critic, and the mind behind The Story of Film and Women Make Film. In collaboration with the iFilm Museum and its current Tilda Swinton exhibition, they discuss his creative partnership with Tilda, his early days interviewing Hollywood's biggest stars, and why cinema still holds such power. You can stream Women Make Film now via the iFilm player. The link is in the show notes. Here's Hugo and Mark.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. My name is Hugo Emerza. I'm joined here today by Mark Cousins. We're here in for a big reason, and namely that we have a new exhibition called Tilda Swinton Ongoing, which is, I would say, an extravagant and deeply immersive dive into the life, work, but also close collaborations of one of the greatest screen icons of our time, Tilda Swinton, which includes huge, collection of fellow cinephiles, filmmakers, artists extraordinaires who are passing through Amsterdam, and one of them being you, Mark Cousins. I'm very excited to have you here because your, career and life is super prolific and storied. You once also started as a film critic, film journalist, then also made some incredible documentaries and films that have been a huge influence on me as well as a budding cinephile when I was younger. So I'm extremely hyped to have you here, Mark. Welcome, first and foremost, Celebrating Cinema. All of our guests, we always ask at the beginning the same question, which is, can you tell maybe a little bit about an early formative memory that you have of experiencing, the power of cinema and the impact that it had on you?
Yes, I can. I was brought up in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and we had the Troubles, the war there. So it was quite a scary place to be. It wasn't a huge war. It was a low temperature war. But I remember going to the cinema, seeing a Disney film called Herbie Rides Again, and it was about a flying motor car and Volkswagen Beetle. And I was, 8 or 9. And I thought, wow, my God, it was so bigger than life when the car took off. But most of my formative experiences were on TV and watching Orson Welles' Touch of Evil.
I can imagine, because I remember watching this film when I was maybe 10 or 11 with my dad. He was like, you need to see this film. And I was so insanely shocked with what you can do with the cinematic language, with the sense of menace and dread and power that crept into the story. So that's super nice. This film made a huge impression on me when I was young as well. Okay, it's very clear, that you are an incredibly receptive person to the power of film, because what I really admire in works like The Story of Film, The Story of Lucan, but also Women Make Film, a documentary series that is also now playing here in I and is, by the way, also shown at the I Film Player, the VOD platform of I, is that you are so incredibly, perceptive to all of these elements, either super big and on a macro level or super granular and tiny, that make the magic of film come alive and come across to the viewer. This receptivity, I think, maybe is already there on the early age. What made you move towards the idea that film is a thing that you can actually work with, that you can actually be involved in what this movie machine actually entails?
So I was always a visual person. I was always bad at words at school. I was never a film journalist. I started as a, I thought I would never make films because I came from a very working class environment where there was, my family were motor mechanics and ordinary jobs. But then I got a little camera and I thought, oh my God, I came alive when I got a little camera. And at first I just directed things for TV. And I kind of was happy doing that, but also I felt that the language of television wasn't poetic enough or personal enough. And so eventually when I got my own cameras, I thought, oh my goodness, I can do something. I can show the beauty of life and the tragedy of life with these little cameras. And so that was when I was in my mid-20s or something, you know, because I didn't have to talk. You know, people I knew, you know, when you meet educated people and middle-class people, they're really good at talking and expressing. But I was always scared of doing that. But as soon as I was making an image, I was alive.
But that's so funny that you say that, also being somewhat afraid or scared or wary of talking, because then why I mentioned that you're kind of like a film journalist is because I've seen many of your television programs as well, where you interview filmmakers, where you come to them, where you talk to the audience about film. And for me, this personal intense level of cinephilia for me was insanely inspiring, because I realized you can actually do this. This can actually be a thing that you share with the world, right?
I directed those shows as well, and I was always more comfortable behind the camera.
Insane.
But yes, I did. You know, once you're in cinema, you're in it. Once you speak that language, you're like a fish in water. And therefore, I was young when I was doing those shows,
yeah,
and quite nervous and introverted. And yet I did them because I would go and meet Jack Lemmon or Lauren Bacall or Martin Scorsese or Polanski. And after maybe 20 minutes, they would realize, oh, he really knows a lot about my career. Like if I would go and interview Jack Lemmon, I would watch all Jack Lemmon's films, etc. And so I found that not only could I sort of do it, it was good for me because it brought me out of my shell. And I'm very interested in shyness, and a lot of people who love movies are very shy.
Yes.
And so suddenly I was on TV directing myself in Hollywood, talking to famous people, and I thought, I'm not terrible at this. And it was, okay, maybe I can progress in this area.
Before we go to the progression, because there's so much to talk about, to be honest, can you maybe, on a bit more textual level, bring us back a little bit to these early days where you're directing yourself, you're stepping in front of the camera, you have all of these, you know, gigantic stars and screen icons and great auteurs in front of your camera. Can you take me a little bit back into this time and what it was like? Or you could, do you have like an anecdote of one of your first recordings, what it was like? Can you kind of situate it for us?
Yeah, I remember sitting in the house of Janet Leigh in the Hollywood Hills. And of course, she was in Touch of Evil when she was in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. And I remember her saying, who do you want to meet? And I was like, and she said, she got on the phone and phoned Carl Malden, you know, who was in Kazan films and many, many things. I said, there's this guy you should meet. And, you know, this was before emails. And I feel as if I was passed around like an object in some way, sometimes it's nice to be an object. So, and Sean Connery, after he met me, he phoned Spielberg and he said, there's this guy you should meet. And I learned from that pass on the connections and pass, you know, help people. And so I've, in my own career, hopefully I've tried as well, when I meet particularly young people who are not from privileged backgrounds, for example, I've tried to pass it on as well. But so there were loads of moments when suddenly the doorbell rings and it's Carl Malden. And you don't have time to look up his career. You have to recall it. There was one particular thing I'll never forget. I went to London, and there was this amazing, I was going to meet Jeremy Thomas, who won 9 Oscars for The Sheltering Sky, but of course did some of the best films of Cronenberg and Bertolucci and Nicholas Ray, etc., etc. And I went in to meet him, but before him I met his colleague called Hercules Belville, and he put out his hand and he said, who directed, which is an American film, and I said, George Axelrod, and he said, you're in. And it was like, okay, you've passed the test, and it's a knowledge test. You know, it wasn't, he didn't say, what school did you go to?
No.
Which is, in the UK, it's a very class codified thing, you know.
Didn't institutional.
Didn't judge. It was like, what's your knowledge? And so I think if I moved quite quickly through the system, which I seemed to do, you know, I was directing things really quite early. I think it was because of knowledge and passion and not being a dick. lots of people in the industry are very elite, and they assume that they deserve to be inside the Citadel. You know, I never assumed that.
Speaking of Jeremy Thomas, you made this, a documentary about him called The Storms of Jeremy Thomas. And I spoke with him once, I interviewed him once when he was at a film festival in Armenia in Yerevan.
Oh, great, yes.
And he had such a admiration and he was so, let's say, he had such warm, I think, memories of the fact that you made this film. And for me, it's so interesting. And I think it's an excellent example of, let's say, the prolificness of the work that you do, that you are interested in huge auteurs, huge directors, screen icons, producers, all of these, let's say, also slightly more invisible or lesser known forces that have made the films that we've grown to love. This omnivorousness, this like huge range in curiosity, where did it kind of like really come from? And also, how do you foster it in, let's say, a constructive way? Because it's great to be an omnivore and it's great to have boundless curiosity, but it can also, of course, be staggering and overwhelming. Because if there's anything that I constantly think when, for instance, I was rewatching Women Make Film, which is a monumental and staggeringly huge project, I was watching it over the weekend. And it's just insane how inexhaustible film history is, right? How much there still is always to discover. So how do you kind of square these two things? This boundless curiosity, but also, let's say, the overwhelming amount of stuff that is out there constantly to be discovered.
Film history is ongoing. There's this current exhibition by Tilda. So the curiosity, I think, for me, my own curiosity comes from the fact that I don't come from the center of anything. I come from a small, troubled city on the edge of Europe and the working class bits of that city. And so I was not brought up in New York or Paris or Los Angeles or any of the capital cities. And when you go to these capital cities, I think you often meet people who feel they are at the center of everything. For a long time, I've really asked the question, what if you're not at the center? Which is the question that Copernicus asked in Poland all the years. What if the world, the planets do not revolve around the Earth? That's the metaphor. That's the excitement. You know, what if I'm not the center of things? What if the brilliance is elsewhere? And the answer is, it's elsewhere and it's everywhere. And once you realize that great things are everywhere and talented people are everywhere, everywhere becomes your passport. It's your destination. It's where you want to be. And that's why I keep going. That's why I'm outwardly directed, that idea of the centrifugal imagination. And so I'm always hungry to go somewhere I've never been before and discover just the architecture, which is my first love, and the cinema of somewhere I haven't been. And that keeps me alive. You know, it keeps me energized. And I've seen a lot of people my age who sort of slightly think, okay, I've done it now.
And then they become slightly complacent and then it's like,
yeah. I've seen the good stuff. I can settle in and just revisit the good stuff. You know, I never want to revisit. The question of being overwhelmed, yes, there is a danger of, because there's always more to discover, always more to see, that sometimes it's not great for you. I don't sleep all that brilliantly. But I don't really complain about that. I'm just happy to get up. I woke up this morning and it said 6:45 and I thought, oh, fuck, it's 6:45. I should be up. You know, and it can be irritating for people around me that I always want to go and do the new thing. But so far, I have dealt with the fact that I don't have an off button.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Yeah, you kind of have the let's say, the markings of a genuine cinephile in the sense of like a nocturnal creature, not a lot of sleep, a lot of, let's say, things, impressions coming at you and then converting them back into something else.
Yeah, and people think of me as a cinephile, but as you know, when I go somewhere new, the first thing I do is look for the buildings.
Yeah.
You know, or the swimming spots. I love nights.
Yes, I know. Yes.
Of course, I love love cinema, but it's part of just a hunger, a desire for the visual world.
Okay, well, we'll get there because this is super interesting as well. But I want to ask one kind of like transitory question, which is about the story of film, An Odyssey.
Yeah.
And what an odyssey it is indeed. And I remember I was in university film studies when around the time that this came out. And I remember also that in, for instance, here in AI, in the Film Institute, but also through cinemas throughout the entire Netherlands, and I assume also the entire world, all of these episodes were being screened, often with introductions, with complimentary extra screenings of films that are included into this monumental series. For me, this was probably a more valuable film education than what was being taught to me in film studies. No offense to my university, but it was just the way that you could break with such relative ease the notion of the canon, mostly the Western dictated canon, could go through film history on a vertical and on a horizontal axis and show, just like you said, all of these relatively undiscovered places throughout the entire world, for me was so gratifying and also mentally opened up a door where I was suddenly realizing, wait, all of these things that I am being taught about what is important in film is so incredibly relative, right? It is just literally how you want to perceive it, and somebody else can also, like you, perceive it a bit for you, so that you're invited to think about it yourself. This is a long leading up, setting the table for a question which maybe has to deal a little bit with responsibility, because when you work with, let's say, undiscovered filmmakers, with territories in the world, filmmaking continents that are often unexplored, unrepresented, how do you square this? How do you go about on this odyssey yourself? And also, is it hard to feel this responsibility to kind of say, the canon exists, but what else is out there? And how can I inform other people, the rest of the world, what is actually there?
Yeah, I think that's quite easy to answer in the end. You know, the main people who should tell us about African cinema are Africans. You know, the main people who should tell us about Chinese cinema are Chinese. But it's, as Tilda Swinton says, cinema is sans frontières. It was about borders. Those of us who are in Europe, we can't only talk about our own stuff. And nor do we have to stick to the idea that just because the main people should tell us, that the rest of us should not talk about that.
There's a double bind almost.
Yeah, we have to, you know. And, you know, if I find myself with a bit of power in this field, I'm going to use it transgressively, if possible, you know. I think certainly in the 21st century, there's quite a lot of identity fundamentalism, I would say, a kind of totalitarianism also, almost, which sort of says that only I can talk about my space. And the whole point about cinema is that it transcends. It is a language which, you know, we can all partially understand. And that's why I'm completely happy to talk about everywhere, a term that I used earlier. You know, cinema is the art of everywhere. And I think, therefore, I'm very happy always be a constant apprentice, always a constant adventurer in cinema, never settle, never rest. There's no place called home in cinema, I think, in a way. And so I just keep going. And the new project, I've just finished something called The Story of Documentary Film, 16 hours. And it's, I think it's wilder and jumping more fences.
But doesn't it have to be? I wanted to ask about this because, you know, I'm, and now this is quite specific, but I'm at a point now in my own, like, life and my perception of the world where I have completely, let's say, shifted a little bit in the sense that I feel like documentaries, the documentary film mode is maybe the most honest one that we have right now to genuinely reflect on all of these insane transitions that the world is going through, which poses a lot of, let's say, staggering questions about what does it mean to capture the things around us in a world that is also not only, let's say, the physical realm, but also these weird digital flux that we live in and all of these things. And I just notice when I see a lot of films at film festivals, which I do, that I tend to gravitate more and more towards documentary cinema because it seems like Maybe it's because the budgets are lower. Maybe it's because filmmakers have less need of a huge, let's say, burdensome film set. Cameras can be small, they can be efficient, but it seems like they respond to things in the world with more transparency and honesty than things that I see often on contemporary fiction cinema. So it's a very interesting time for me to think about documentary cinema as a whole. So I am insanely excited about this project that you're undertaking.
I'm quite excited by it now. It's just finished. Yeah, I mean, the question is, can documentary kill fascism? That's basically it.
You know,
simple as that. Let's put it in one sentence. You know, and the answer is no, but it can help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your question is, why are documentaries often more interesting than fiction films? Because the documentary impulse is not to say, you know, I am a genius and I will share my inner world with you. The documentary impulse is to say the outer world is so amazingly complex that if we just be slightly submissive to it, it will capture the complexity of that. Of course, there's that phrase, you know, life is stranger than fiction, and it certainly is. Like, I'm moving hotel today and I was on my phone and I thought, I must look up the address of my new hotel. I looked it up and I stood up and I was standing right in front of it. Now, if you put that in a fiction film, that simply wouldn't play.
No.
It wouldn't play. You would cut that out of the screenplay. What you're saying to the audience is, you know, in broad terms, you know, this is not made up. In broad terms, this is not overstaged. And therefore, there's more danger in it. The danger of things going wrong, the danger of, you know, it being formless and structureless. And that's why, you know, documentary isn't only necessary when times are bad. It's necessary at all times. And it's one of the great art forms. You know, it's a new consciousness in the world, the documentary art form, because it's not exactly like the old style journalism that there was in newspapers from the, let's say, the 1700s, much before that. It's something, a new type of consciousness. It's quite different in some way from fiction cinema. And it's a glorious art form.
Yeah, I mean, personally, now I have a deep found fascination for Ukrainian war documentaries and the way that the war becomes this vast resource that poses a lot of interesting challenges to documentary filmmakers based in Ukraine as to how to cinematically respond to an onslaught and deluge of images, events, stories, but also mostly how much of that is filtered through digital means and digital communication, how much is coming in through Telegram channels, Twitter, news feeds, and how all of these tiny bits of digital content can also be building blocks for what we could call cinema. And I feel like there's this interesting moment now where cinema is not only the realm of people, faces, places, but it is also this weird in-betweenness that is between all of these realms that is communicating, slipping through of our lives. And I'm just wondering what you think of this kind of like interesting era where also cinema has to share a lot of our attention with a lot of other audiovisual methods of communication, like the anecdote you tell about, you know, looking up where's your hotel on the phone. A lot of people are obviously quite worried about the lower hierarchy of cinema in audiovisual media. I find that is not entirely justified, but I'm just wondering how you kind of perceive this change of, let's say, texture and language of the audiovisual image in recent decades.
I mean, the people who are really worried about that are often older people. They're sort of cultural pessimists who think that the best time is behind us. A lot of people of a certain age think this, the 60s were the best time, and then the 80s were the best time, then the 90s were the best time. So it's a kind of nostalgia, a golden age, that wrap that in a box and say, that was magnificent, and it's been a shit show since then, you know. But that, of course, is not true. And, of course, the other thing that's totally true is the visual texture that you're talking about changes all the time. And when something new comes along, like the VR camera or whatever, you think, you know, when I first saw VR technology, I just thought, okay, Georges Méliès would have loved this.
Yes, of course, yes.
And, you know, AI, when AI came along, AI came along fully when I was making the story of documentary film. And I just made a note to myself. I said, this is like being in the 1830s when photography came along, being a painter in the 1830s, so the painters thought, well, I don't need to do clouds anymore. I don't really need to know faces because photography can do that immediately. So what can I do that it can't? And so there was AI. Obviously, I use AI in some small areas, but my question to myself as a filmmaker is, what can I do that it can't? What kind of visual thinking can I do that it can't? And in the story of documentary film, I've always been interested in unusual connections and jumps between films and moments, but I'm way pushing that further because an AI will never make those connections. And it's a summary mechanism at the moment. Like when about a year and a half ago, I asked AI, what is the history of documentary cinema? And it gave me an almost exact summary of a book that I did with Kevin MacDonald 30 years ago. And I thought, well, fuck, is that all you got? You know, you're not a lot of fun girlfriends, you know? So just, you know, I thought, okay, we're safe still. You know, if I can still be imaginative in the way I talk about, in this case, documentary cinema, AI is not catching up.
Then I think it's a good time to talk about things like architecture, cities, places, environments, and how they relate to your work as a filmmaker, but also your life, your perception of the world around you. And I think it would be good to point this question towards a film like I Am Belfast, which is, I assume, an incredibly important film for you to make because it's also how you situated yourself at the beginning of this interview, right? You come from, let's say, a marginal environment, from, let's say, not incredibly hot war, but a very, let's say, sensitive area of Europe from a very distinct time. And then you find yourself as a filmmaker with the resources to maybe cinematically respond to this complex relationship to the place where you came from. What was it like for you to, let's say, use the camera to go more inwards, to go a bit more back home, and then also try to find ways to process all of these layers of time, history, environment, architecture, etc., but also your personal emotions within this film?
Yeah, thank you for asking about that. I left Belfast when I was 17, and I didn't make a film about it for 25 years. I went elsewhere, everywhere but. You know, lots of us have mixed feelings about the place we come from and really want to escape it, and I wanted to escape it for a long time. I tried not to think about it. It was quite a conservative town, very religious. So I just did other things. And then eventually I thought, it's not going away. That place that I came from, it's, you know, this small city, this not very pretty city that has fought itself and yet has got a great human warmth. I thought, I need to go there and ask myself, you know, can I do something cinematic about it? And then I thought of the film Soy Cuba, I Am Cuba, a great film, and I thought, okay, and what if I impersonate Belfast? What if I invent a 10,000-year-old woman had been in West Africa by that time and heard all this idea of the griot, the mythic storyteller? He doesn't come from the real world. He comes from a kind of mythic world. I thought, that's the way I'll do it. I'll talk about Belfast, where journalists have always talked about it, in a totally non-journalist. And I said, okay, I can do this. And so I walked every single street. It took me 6 months or slightly more. And then I asked Christopher Doyle, the great cinematographer, Wong Kar-wai, if he would shoot some of it. And we made a film. And it was non-journalistic. You know, it was more, it was influenced by Virginia Woolf and that idea of the, in French, the male is flâneur and the female is flâneuse. What would the female walker, observer of this city in transition, think? And it was fun to do.
I love how the curiosity triggers all of these interesting, you know, conceptual ideas that open up new formal strategies to approach these things, to, like you say, sidetrack something.
And also I'm quite childlike in some ways, you know, like, so I'm not, certainly not an academic, and I don't use academic language. So when I'm in Belfast, there are moments where this old ladies just looking at flowers and patterns on the street and just enjoying the ordinariness of Belfast, you know, not seeing it as a topic, not seeing it as a problem, just seeing it as a place.
Mark, I have two more questions. One of them is related to Women Make Film, which is now being screened tonight, but again, it's on the iFilm player as well. And of course, since we are here in the context of the exhibition Tilda Swinton ongoing, it signifies this super interesting collaboration, creative collaboration that you have with Tilda Swinton as the narrator of this multi-part documentary series, which dives through film history, but also actually, I would say, becomes more a miniature masterclass of various entry points in how we actually think about what a film is, because you offer so many different options and ideas and granular little insights in what actually is going on.
It's really practical. How do you do an opening shot? How do you get people to meet each other? How do you shoot a sex scene? It's really it's pure filmmaker's perspective on cinema, I think.
Exactly. And then you tie it to a trove of treasures of film made by women directors from the entire world, again, all of the filmmaking continents. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, also this undertaking, but also what it means for you to have such a luminous star like Tilda Swinton attached to something like this, which is so insanely specific for so many people, but maybe it becomes more approachable because some person like Tilda Swinton is attached?
Yeah, there are six narrators in this film.
Yes.
Jane Fonda.
Yes.
Tilda Swinton. The genius that is Shamila Tagore, you know, the Elizabeth Taylor of Indian cinema, on and on and on, you know. So it was six narrators. And in each case, I wanted to work with, you know, super talented women who shared the idea that we're not going to be gender fundamentalists. We're not going to say, here's what women are like. We're not going to say that they're empaths or that they make films that are specifically about relationships. None of that shit, you know. Women make films about everything. You know, and so that was the joy of it. We were not doing that work. You know, we're not sort of saying women did sex scenes different than men. I would just be like, have you seen Catherine Breillat's films? It was a kind of, we say nothing, absolutely nothing about what women are in this. We talk about the work of I think it's 800 films. But we talk about I imagined of these 800 films. And I can't tell you the number of directors who are in this film who came to me afterwards and said, thank you, I feel seen, because you're not talking about another fucking panel about how do we get more women in the film industry. Like, they've been, you know, you're actually talking about my work. What to do? How did I shoot that war scene or that, you know, that road movie or that sci-fi? I mean, that was, like, when I was at university, there was a section on you studied literature or you studied women's literature as if it was some kind of subsection specialist case. And it was like, no, we're not doing that. We're just talking about these people as filmmakers.
On a very, very trivial, but I think also essential note, I wanted to ask a question about the tattoos because I love them so much. I've seen you post about them before on social media. I've seen them in real life before as well. Can you talk maybe about what is, just for the context for the listeners, we have here basically a bit of the history of cinema also on your arms. Actually, I can join you a little bit as well because I have, this is from Miami Vice by Michael Mann.
Yeah, right.
This is my favorite film of all time.
Cool.
So I'm maybe at the beginning of a journey where you've already been for a long time. What's the favorite and what's the
first
latest?
Tattoo is on my leg and it says WB, Walter Benjamin.
Hi.
I really love his writing. And that sounds slightly too pretentious, but I just love his
writing. But his writing is fun. It's not
so brilliant.
Yes.
You're brilliant. And then since we're talking about when I make film, we've got Kira Muratova here.
One of my favorite directors of all
time. Yeah. And for decades, I've been writing about her. And certainly in the Anglo world, you know, she's really not known. And I said, I remember writing an article saying, you know what's going to happen? She's going to die. And then there are going to be articles about how great she was. Voila, that's what happened. So she is in that arm. On my right arm here is Kinyo Tanaka, who people, she was known as being an actor in Ozu Mitsuguchi, but she was a great director as well.
She's also quite prominently in Women Make Film as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Beside her is Marie Curie, a physicist. I studied physics. That's my background. And so they have when I'm stuck in life, I often think, what would Marie Curie do? And Farrukh Farrukhzad from Iran. So quite a few. I think there are more women on my arms than men.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like a living piece of art. What a treasure. What a pleasure to speak with you, Mark. I think we could do this like the entire day, the entire year. So Thank you so much.
Pleasure, my friend. Thanks so much.
Such a pleasure.
Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't miss Tilda Swinton and Derek Jarman's Caravaggio, now screening at Lab 111. Also, explore Tilda's ode to collaboration in the form of an exhibition at iFilm Museum, running until February 8th.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. If you love what we do, support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. And don't forget to check the show notes for all the films mentioned, bonus info, and ticket links. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF. Thank you.